Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Ryan. How you doing?
Oh, I am doing as well as one can. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay.
Just okay?
Yep, just okay.
Have you been wondering about whatever happened to Yum Yum Energy in our podcast?
It's always here, so I don't need to worry about it. It hasn't gone missing.
It hasn't gone missing. We don't need to search for it within every single episode that we do of the pod.
No, we do.
Okay, so at least there's
it's not that. Missing, but we need to look for it, just like gratitude.
Oh, look at that. Rachel's being all fancy. And patience and love, of course. And 5-star reviews from you, the listening people out there, from you, the yumlings. You're listening to Yum Yum Podcast, a podcast where we look over some science fiction television. A husband and wife team down here in the Marxist capital of Australia. And oh, what a series we are looking at. We're looking at Babylon 5 currently. We're in the 4th season of it, Rachel. We're 4 seasons in to Babylon 5. Isn't that just amazing that we've made it this far?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Rachel sounds minorly impressed. It takes a lot to impress Rachel, and maybe why we called ourselves Yum Yum is the thing that impresses Rachel the most. In fact, she's so bowled over by it that she's going to lay it out for us right now.
We are named Yum Yum thanks to Star Trek Discovery writing, editing, an actor getting paid to deliver. And then, you know, the film editor keeping that take in.
Yeah. Use the word film. In fact, call it cinema. Make Scorsese proud. A character, that's a strong phrase, said the line
individual.
Yum Yum randomly. It was out of nowhere. No, this didn't come out in the young early days of Star Trek's history. No, this didn't come out in the 60s. This, in fact, came out only a few years ago. And it inspired us. It bowled us over. It was such a monumental moment that we had to name the podcast after it. And we take it everywhere we go. And we remind you every single week how great that line is. Just, in fact, it's so great. Let's hear it again.
Yum, yum.
We're rewatching, revisiting, and reviewing episodes of B5. And today we're looking over the season 4, episode 2. And it is called, Rachel, do you remember? Do you remember the title?
Whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi?
That's a great question. I hope it answers it in the 45 minutes. we both know. The DVD description describes the episode as such. A friend never lets down another friend. Jakar intensifies his search for Garibaldi, his first ever non-Narn friend. Meanwhile, Sheridan's search for a way out coalesces as he encounters the mysterious Lorien. Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi is an episode, and we both have seen it. So, Rachel, I want to know your overall relationship with this.
I remember being frustrated by this episode on first viewing because it doesn't give you anything concrete, but so much happens but nothing happens. It's just like the first episode is such a banger with all of these things being set in motion, and this one is those very specific cogs turning just a little bit. Like, it's not the bigger ones, flashy ones on the outside of the mechanism that is Babylon 5. Mm-hmm. That's the little cogs in the middle that just turn a little bit and it will ripple out and make more major impacts.
Is this your way of saying you were disappointed that Sheridan and Delenn didn't embrace and kiss each other and fuck? Is this your complicated way of saying that, because I know that's you're very keen on that to happen.
Yeah, but, like...
He has a new partner now, Sheridan.
That wasn't where I was going, Ryan.
Where were you going? That you upset that Marcus has a new partner too? A much sexier partner over Ivanova that is Jakar?
What's your history, Ryan?
Well, I really latched on to the one thing, which was the craziness that is Sheridan's existence in the story. I was a teenager when seeing this that first time, and so I was in the age of Heroes and Lost and Fringe being TV shows that were big at the time and or I was watching. And even then, I was very overdone with mysterious, ooh, characters that come into a story. Like, ooh, what happens if we have a bunker that's underneath the ground and we open up the hatch to it and there's a guy in there that knew, like, that's Lost. And so when this came into my life, when I saw it all those years ago, I really wasn't pleased with the Lorien stuff. I was very guarded about it. My hackles were up. I was going, oh, you're gonna have to win me over. I was Garibaldi, basically, in later episodes, where I was suspicious. I didn't want this. There was a lot of flowery, philosophical mumbo-jumbo talk in that I found very eye-rolling, and so I was not the most positive on this, but overall I've not hated the episode. That was just my guttural reaction. Now, having viewed it today, I think it's okay. I think it's a fairly decent episode, but it just doesn't have that wow factor. Oof. Of the previous, of the Hour of the Wolf. The pacing's a little bit slower. I was looking over the notes that we wrote down to discuss, and each one of the things that we'll discuss has some depth to it and some interesting material in there, but it just doesn't have that razor edge precision that the previous one did. How did you feel about it on this watch?
It was fine. Like, it didn't hold my attention very well. Because I was like, okay, this is happening. Okay. I felt like a buffer. Like, all of these things needed to happen because of the overarching things. But on their none of the parts individually of this episode are very compelling.
There's good scenes. There's good character interactions
the arcs
and beats
within this episode are like, okay. Okay. And then, but it's like, fuck yeah, Jakar.
Oh, we have to ask and answer the question of who had YYE, Yum Yum Energy. Who in Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi had the energy of the Yum Yum moment of Star Trek Discovery? A what was this energy?
Kataj is here.
Well, so you're going to go with Kataj?
Like, he's an easy pick. He's an easy pick, and Jakar is here, and I love his energy levels.
Verini's here.
Verini's here.
He's mincing and knocking at the door furiously. Malari! Mm-hmm. Malari! I have a different pick. One that is also a Centauri.
The guard.
That fucking guy. He had a big old smirk on his face when they found out it was Jakar. Mm-hmm. And he got shot first, by the way, guy by Jakar. But he had such unlimited YYE that it made me notice the character. He just had this just this overall vibe to him that was, because he was being a shit-eating grin type character. He was very smug and arrogant and determined. And he also visually had this look to him of this schlubby, washed up Centauri guard that has now struck upon gold. And that's not even within the script. That is just from the actor that they chose and the costuming that they gave him and just the way he carried himself, that I have this background for this guy, that this is some loser Centauri guard that's on the outreaches of whatever planet in the galaxy.
Why the fuck are they even here?
Partying. Partying it up on the lightning planet. That's the best I could give you. Do you have an answer?
No, that's why I asked the question.
But you gave me a, okay, and you have your arms folded and you're looking at me like, I don't, you know, your answer's good, Ryan, but it's no, they were teaching the orphans how to cheat at cards with their penises.
Did you think these were just decorations? I'm going to take a vow of silence concerning this entire conversation.
Season 4 opens the can of whoop-ass that is Jakar and Marcus teaming up. And I really want to shine a light on the strength of both Marcus and Jakar as characters, but also their actors, in terms of you get to this stage of the show and you can pair these characters up with pretty much anyone, and you'll get an interesting dynamic or a fun scene. Marcus and Franklin, they're very fun. Marcus and Garibaldi, they are very much bickering and they have a thing. Marcus and Ivanova clearly have such a great dynamic to see on screen. And Jakar, you put him in a scene with any other character. Veer, you put him in a scene with Veer and it's a very dramatic, heartbreaking elevator sequence. Or you put him in any scene with Londo, or you have him face off against this person and that person. Like, literally last week we had him and Zach Allen having a conversation and it was a very compelling sequence. And both of these characters have that unique flavor to them where they just can bounce off anyone else with their own flair to it. And both Jason Carter and Andreas Katsoulis have just a certain on-screen charisma that they generate with other players that they're off against. So to team them up together in this one was, mwah. I very much enjoyed seeing Marcus needle at Jakar and bother him. What did you think about that? Because We just have Jakar off Babylon 5, which in itself is a crazy image to see, by the way. To see him not in the B5 land is just unusual. We saw him on Narn last season, and that was unusual. But here, he's all alone, he's looking for Garibaldi, he's about to get attacked, or maybe he wasn't, maybe he had it all under control, and there's Marcus there to be a British Ranger quipster. What do you think about the pairing of these two?
It's great. It's not quite as good as Franklin and Marcus.
Nothing is. I don't think there's a better pairing in the show than those two, honestly.
No.
Oh, well, Jakar and Londo.
And we know we're getting closer to that.
We've gotten our taste for now. Well, what do you think of these two, though? Because they get a lot to do with one another.
Yeah, they do. I like the way that Marcus respects Jakar. It's in a very different way to the type and expression of respect that he gives Sheridan Ivanova Delenn. Like, there is this spiritual appreciation of Jakar as a person that Marcus manages to emote.
They have a lot in common with one another that you're surprised to actually realize, because they also have a lot of differences to them. But when you put them in a scene together, Marcus does annoy Jakar. He annoys him, but it's in a very overtly fun way, and Jakar's having fun with it. It's also fun because he brings out season one Jakar energy out of him, Marcus, where you get a lot of Andreas Kotsoulis just going, oh, I never, oh, it really reminded me of the Gathering side of Jakar, where you had a lot of him just, oh, how dare you? You put a tracking thing in, you put a thing in my belly? And with Jakar to Marcus, he also has fun needling him as well, where you have the whole Pykel envy conversation between the two, and eventually he gives the pike over to Jakar and he presses a button and just wrecks some shit in the room, and Jakar is...
The cat screech?
The cat screech, as you have to. And Jakar really likes the pike, and you see the look on Marcus's face of, that's not what I want you to say. I don't want you to, I don't want you to own my pike now.
No, I don't want you to risk stealing my pike.
I really liked when they were both quiet with one another. He had some fun stuff like Jakar brushing his teeth where he dips his finger and rubs it with his finger, and then he gargles, but he has nowhere to spit it, so he swallows it, and he's like, ugh, and you see Marcus interacting with that. But I really like the conversation between the two, where Jakar lays out why he's looking for Garibaldi and why he must do this, and that Garibaldi is his first ever friend that wasn't a Narn. And then Marcus reflects that, well, you're my first friend who was a Narn. And how Marcus then gets all edgelordy again, where I don't have many friends, and the ones that I did, they're gone now. They've died or they're dying. And just Jakar having to... It's an interesting dynamic at play, because you have Marcus there to protect and look after Jakar, and he does that by being the badass. I've got a pike, I'm going to make quips and flip around and do a little bit of... a little bit of searching around. Oh, I found this guy. Let's go get him and interrogate him. But you have Jakar in return consoling and looking after Marcus in the way that he can do that now, which is through his wisdom, through his philosophical and spiritual guidance. And yeah, the moment where he's basically telling him that this is a mission for me alone... He makes a very compelling case, because narratively, JMS has to come up with a reason for why Jakar will be by himself and get captured by the Centauri. And also just so that Jakar can fulfill the mission that he set out to without having Marcus to be there, because Marcus doesn't really have a strong relationship with Garibaldi or with Jakar, so... You either, if you did have him there, you'd have to build up a strong relationship with Marcus and Jakar to warrant Marcus being here. Or you do what they do here, which is get a reason for Marcus to leave. And I didn't feel the writer's hand as strongly with that. I think I feel the shadow of that hand looming over the script here, because... You do have to get to the end result, which is Jakar getting captured by the Centauri, and you can't have Marcus there unless you're either going to incapacitate Marcus or have him captured as well, or just not have him there. And so they went with that particular option. What was your reaction overall to Jakar getting captured? Because they have a whole scuffle in the bar. The bartender, the owner of the bar, rats him out to the Centauri guards, and they're thrilled to see that it's Jakar that they can go after. And so they send a whole squad of them over. Jakar fights it out, but what's been your overall reactions to Jakar getting caught?
I just think of it as inevitable, because I know where the story goes. And I'm like, even on the first watch, I was like, I don't believe that he's going to stay on Babylon 5 forever. Because the Centauri aren't leaving Narn. They aren't losing power. They're gaining it. So it was like, well, it makes sense for him to end up with the Centauri, and it's a natural evolution of the stakes of the situation, right?
You have to come to a head at some point with the non-occupation.
And also because we have that foreshadowing of him dying on Centauri Prime and fighting with Londo to the death, them choking each other.
Killing him out of friendship and mercy, yeah.
Yes. And our evolution of that, like, understanding of that has evolved.
I look at it as well at the impressive pacing that season four has, because I remembered being actually quite surprised that they got him so quickly, because I was thinking, oh, you're going to have Jakar out and about for a couple of episodes. And
on the run.
On the run, having to evade people and getting more information on whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi, because the title of the episode is called Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi. Jakar is the only person actively engaging with that plot, and so to have him captured halfway through the story here, halfway through this episode, let alone having it continue for multiple, I was really thrown off by that, because I was, one, not, like I said, not expecting him to be caught so soon, but then, well, what is going to happen with Garibaldi now? Who's going to take up that mantle? Is it going to be Marcus? Is it going to be Zach?
Is anybody going to keep looking for him?
Or is he going to get out himself? Because we do get quick flashes of he has been captured. He's in some interrogation and he's being asked this question, these questions over and over again. And he's gassed and he's violent and he's knocked out, and a Psy-Corp, or at least a Psy-Corp member, is behind this. So that gives us an inclination of where we will be going in the future with that story. But it still didn't give me any certainty of how Garibaldi would come back into the fold, because Jakar was the one to help bring him back into it. And now Jakar has been captured by the Centauri, and it was rather sudden.
Yeah.
But there's something to be praised there, though, about how it is what Londo describes when he meets Jakar in the cell, where obviously you were going to get captured. As soon as you left Babylon 5, we were going to get you. That was an inevitability. And so having it happen so quickly just gives us an understanding of the strength of the Centauri and their determination. And that there is something that was really palpable on this watching.
They seem rather eager to find you. Eagerness like that
worries you. Well, I suppose I should appreciate your concern. Compassion is a rare commodity these days.
We almost went the whole episode without Londo and Kataja and Verini, but they all come back in full force.
They come through.
Because Kataja has to summon Londo.
Immediately.
Immediately, late into the night, to give him the gift that we find out is Jakar.
As soon as he arrives.
And
well, Kataja calls Jakar an it. I'm pretty sure.
Verini knocking at the door late at night, just continuously knocking. That was one of my favorite bits in the episode. I had a good laugh at the opening of the door, and there he is already with his hands up and flailing motions. Umlari!
Finally!
Finally! And when he closes the door on him, he just reacts with like, no, no!
No, no, I don't want to be killed for this.
That guy.
I can't go back empty-handed.
That man. And when we go to the Emperor's Royal Court, when we go to the throne room, the actor Damien London, who plays Verini, he's just chewing into the scenery, because he's getting dismissed by Kataja, and he walks past Londo, and he's just his hands are shaking, and you just see the look of terror on his face, and hear these very, very, very gentle mumblings to himself, like, oh, I'm gonna die, he's gonna kill me. That thing, these are the details that make the whole Reign of Kataja storyline so good, because his madness over the Centauri royal court spreads out to characters like Verini and to all of these sycophants or people that are afraid to move against him. And I want to hear from you what you thought about Londo in this moment here, where he's having to explain and bend and play the game to Kataja about why he is not on time to come here.
Why he didn't come immediately. And he tries to play the game the old way, while also appealing to a madman. And there's this sense of, like, I might not get away with this, but this is my play.
He's acting.
Yeah. It's just like, okay, I'll say the things that I think he wants to hear.
Which are?
Which is utterly ridiculous and appealing to his ego of, I wouldn't dare greet you in my pajamas. I had to be dressed properly because I have respect for you and your position even more. Like,
which is fair. That's like understandable logic. You're like, yeah, that makes sense, but that's not good enough.
Also, Londo using that little bit of the truth, which is that he does have extreme allegiance to the role of emperor, not to Kataja.
He's a traditionalist.
But he twists his words around to make it sound
palatable.
Yes.
And then Kataja, I love Wertham Crimmer's delivery of this, where it's both a threat and a cutesy little game for him of, oh, so I shouldn't kill you then? I should spare your life?
I would be killing a part of myself, so I guess I'm...
Well, that's the thing that I really adored about Londo is he's, like you said, he's appealing to this madman's sense of worth and ego. So he constructs this whole little soliloquy, basically, where if you kill me, you're killing a part of yourself, and you wouldn't want to do that, nor would I want you to do that, because I'm here to make sure you're okay. And it's this ludicrous logic that he has to go through to stop Kataja's insanity from amping up, because he's a character that can easily swing one way or the other. And Peter Jurasek's acting. Because that's actually quite difficult to pull off, because he has to play the guy who we, the audience, know he's fucking terrified.
Yeah.
But he has to also make sure to not play that so overtly that we, the audience, wouldn't also suspect that the other character interacting with him would see that. And so it's a...
I also look at this scene as further evidence that Londo is locked in to this plan. And in so doing, he's like, either I'm going to die, and then he's going to die, we're both going to die, or like...
It's like when Jakar was going to kill the previous emperor, and he had all of these determined, oh, this is how it's going to play out. And, well, when we get to Kataja, we also see how things don't play out to plan, but...
Yes, but it's like Londo accepts that he's doomed. At this point, it's just like, I could take a step to the left and he decides to kill me.
This is Londo reaping what he sows, and he even reaps more what he sows when Kataja brings him the gift that is Jakar in chains. And this is something Londo has wanted. He's wanted Jakar's head on a silver platter, right? Like, he wanted to have him brought in and executed, and he wanted to dehumanize and defeat this foe of his, this rival of his. But this is the point where the classic Londo, he doesn't actually want what he wants. When he's actually confronted with it, when he's forced to sit there and look at it and actually see the realities of it all, it horrifies him, it repels him, it makes him coil inwards on himself. And Peter Jurasek, again, the first episode was a lot of reaction shots of him looking completely mortified at the horrors that he sowed, and this is another example of that. The look on his face when Katarja starts ringing the little bell and Jacquard is there, he is holding his hand over his heart, like he is that staggered by this that his heart is clearly racing. And Jacquard is so focused on what he was set out to do.
He's got a mission.
Do you know what happened to Mr. Garibaldi? He's asking about Garibaldi. I love the Emperor's reaction, just a classic.
Who?
And even Londo is confused by this. Possibly the best moment within this second episode is the conversation in the cell between Londo and Jacquard, these two men. And oh, the direction here, the cinematography and lighting and overall blocking of the scene really played around with the subtext that was happening in the conversation and the power dynamics, because Londo can open up that door and his shadow will completely engulf and be on top of Jacquard sitting on the ground. But as we go along in the sequence, we have Jacquard is, even though he's sitting on the ground, he's rigid and firm, and he's in the right, while Londo, he starts out upright and tall and eventually crawls down onto his knees to plead in a manner to Jacquard to help him do what he must do. And I truly adore, possibly one of my favorite images of Jacquard in the entire series, is when Londo exits the scene, he opens up the cell door, and we see...
bathed in light.
We see Jacquard bathed in light.
Just for a moment.
And he reacts to it with absolute glee. It's a beautiful sequence of both Jacquard is in absolute glee about the deal that he struck with Malari for the Centauri to leave his world, but also to get that real light onto his skin. Oh, it's truly...
He's a lizard! It's marsupial!
It's truly a masterfully constructed scene on almost every single level. So do you want to talk us through a bit about what's going on within the conversation between the two?
Londo needs Jacquard. So we realize that Londo doesn't have a specific plan yet as to how to get rid of Katarja. We know that he will formulate a long-term plan because that's his style. We've discussed that sort of in comparison with Reefer a number of times.
Mm, and definitely in comparison and contrast to Katarja.
So he's looking around for the opportunities and he sees Jakar's capture as one. I don't think he fully knows what it looks like yet, but he knows that having Jacquard on the inside can be a very, very powerful thing.
Mm. And
because it's like he needs something that's going to hold Katarja's attention, and Jacquard as a very high profile and powerful nun is likely to do.
And he details about how they will do these truly atrocious things to Jacquard for a long time.
They will make you suffer for their entertainment. They will torture you. Like, I can't stop this, but I can maybe stop your death if you cooperate with me.
You will have to endure, though. That is the thing that he asks of Jacquard, which is what Jakar is burdened with as a character. He has to endure. We've seen him really have to come to terms with that for himself and for the Narn, that they have to endure to become better. And having Londo sit there and tell him that he must do this to help the Centauri is truly a bold move on his part. And I just also want to comment upon Londo is realizing that Jakar will be a distraction long enough to get the Emperor's attention so that they can make this assassination happen. And it's actually quite nice that they're seeding that notion into the audience's mind, because one of the struggles that will come up soon is that the Emperor's attention starts to wane and starts to fade when torturing Jakar, because of Jakar's remaining pride gets in the way of the entertainment factor of this absolutely sadistic man.
Yeah.
So I think that's rather neat to look at within this single episode, that in the audience's mind, we're being told that if you team up with me, you will be the distraction for the Emperor. But we will see that Jakar's inherent characterization, like his inherent personality, will in a way impede the plan going forward as well, which is cool.
Yeah, he will need to, in a way, this is testing his acceptance of the message from Kosh that some will suffer and some will die for the benefit of the whole. And he's said or alluded to the fact that he is willing to do that for his people. A number of times he said that, but he's trying hard not to compromise what he holds dear, and that is his pride.
Babylon 5 is really, really skilled at showing the course of history being sculpted and moved and made by these individuals making these on the moment choices that will help forge a new way. That's been Londo. Londo's Mr. Oh, I'll just tell this guy what I want and then do this. And before you know it, now there's a war. And before you know it, now there's an occupation. And before you know it, now there's a madman on the throne. And just
snowball of decisions.
And that is what's happening here with Jakar, though, where Jakar, having gone on this adventure to find Mr. Garibaldi, will in turn help free Narn. And here in this dungeon with Londo, his most despised enemy, he's going to ensure that that happens.
If I remove the monster from your throne, you will remove the monster from my world. Leave Narn. Set my world free. Promise me this, and I will do as you ask.
Delenna has a problem.
You know it's a problem because Lanier has to break.
Break your promise.
He has to break the code of conduct.
Code of conduct.
And, he has to come to the only person he knows that can help Delenn in her crisis right now. No, it's not Narun.
Nope.
Garibaldi's not here. Sheridan, well, he's a part of the problem, isn't he?
Oh, that motorcycle can't talk.
Ivanova's too busy drinking, probably, late into the night. Zach?
No.
He didn't show up this episode. He's too busy looking at that Daffy Duck poster and praying to it. Who does Lanier go to help Delenn? And,
well, it's a medical problem. So, of course, he goes to
Dr. Hobb.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But Dr. Hobb is busy. We don't. Second choice goes to Franklin.
Oh, yeah, the Markab doctor died, so she can't see him. So, Franklin, huh?
Yes.
We get a personal log with him. He helps open up the episode.
Yeah. Because Delenn is still fasting, but this is a problem because she's no longer solely Minbari. So it's probably fucking up her body more than it would if she was she hadn't gone through the chrysalis.
What do you think about Franklin and him going forward? Because I think about Franklin's character overall with the Stims plot, but now that we are over that and we have a far more level-headed and grounded Franklin, what do you think about him here? And also being paired with Delenn throughout this entire episode.
I think it makes a lot of sense because he helped her at the end of the transformation process as well. So it makes a lot of sense that Linnea would go straight for Franklin, despite our joking buffle. So it tracks and it feels right. And it's just like, yep, this is how he would respond post walkabout. He doesn't go in guns blazing. He doesn't go in disrespecting her beliefs. He goes in fairly level, focusing on the facts and reminding her that support is available. And also, post-believers, acknowledging the importance of her values.
And her cultural background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was really shocked upon that because he was rather confused when she emerged from the chrysalis. So when he was interacting with her there, he was experiencing something that nobody knew what was happening there. So he looked at it more as a strange curiosity.
It's like the xenobiologist lens was on.
But more importantly, what was on there was he was dragged into a situation that he had no understanding of. Like, even beyond just xenobiologist, he was just told, come in here, look at this, and he just is, what? Here, though, he knows Delenn on a personal level. He knows what's happening. He knows why.
He knows what starvation is.
Well, he knows why she's doing this. And yes, even post-walkabout Franklin, in terms of like his mentality, is softer. But I think it's also because he's coming at this from not just the doctorly point of view. He isn't just Dr. Franklin here. He is the friend. He is the person that is here on the level of sympathetic. So yes, he's telling her what's negative about what she's going through and that he cares and that other people care. He's trying to at first connect with her on the level of letting her know that everyone else around you is worried and that they care about you, and it doesn't work.
No.
He also does bring up the medical stuff, but that isn't the sole driving thing that would have been in the past. And
if it's like he no longer believes, if I can just convince her that she's harming her body, she'll stop. He knows that it's more than that. He doesn't think that he can just logic his way through and convince her to get help or to eat something or whatever it is to address the problem.
He takes the steps that many people often do when they're in a conflict or seeing someone in a crisis, which is to come at them with the external, which is to say, hey, I'm worried about you, or hey, your friends want to make sure that you're not in danger, or all of those things, right? We oftentimes come at it from that external initially to get through to the internal, to get through what's happening with that person themselves. And that's what Franklin does here. That's how he goes through this. Because it doesn't work. Delenn tells him to go, that she's going to keep doing this. She's not going to stop. And so what's his course of action, Rachel? What does he do to help alleviate what the problem is?
So he respects her position and sort of reaffirms it, like, you know, he's available and other people are if she wants to talk or get help in any way. Then a couple of scenes later, they meet back up again at Sheridan's quarters.
Yeah, he calls for her.
Yeah, he calls her in there because Ivanova is getting Franklin to clear out his stuff and decide what goes where and who keeps what. And
what gets archived and stored for later. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so he's been given access to all the personal logs.
Yes.
And I guess he's a little snoop. And he started going through them. Hey, do you think he did a control F and went for Franklin first?
Yes.
I know I would. Seriously, yeah. Wouldn't you?
Yes.
Oh, immediately.
It's like, we've both been bad people and read other people's diaries at different points in our lives.
Oh,
and
you look
for your name.
You look for your name.
You look for you or for days where you know that you were with them to see if they mention you.
I didn't go to that level. But no,
well, the diaries that you were reading weren't dated a lot.
And they were found in shallow graves. No, I just find it amusing to think about what Sheridan is talking about when it comes to Franklin outside of him resigning. Like, I want to hear those logs where he just goes, ha-ha, so Franklin was telling me about these parasites that took over the homeless? Babylon 5 is one crazy place to work at.
Beside the point.
I was too busy hitting baseballs at the baseball diamond
Franklin
that we have at the station.
Franklin gives Delenn a little data crystal that has a snippet from a personal log that has him talking about how, oh, golly gee, I just love her so much.
I love her, and by gosh, I'm in love with Minbari.
And that's complicated, and like I have all of these feelings about it, but I'm all in now. Oh. I can't not be in love with her.
Large thrust of the problem here was what she did at the end of the last season and how she betrayed his trust and that she realized that she was being far too Minbari in the relationship there and that maybe she shouldn't have loved him so much. And so Franklin, hearing that, manages to stumble across this thing where it shows the human side of the relationship there, where Sheridan, the man, the guy, the human, got so much out of their moments together. And this is him talking about how much he is infatuated with her, and it moves her so much. You see this smile beaming on her face, and I really appreciated the quiet story here between Franklin and Delenn. It's not loud, it's not too flashy, it's not too emotionally wrought. It is just a series of scenes that do help move Delenn into the next stage, which is to now focus in her grief. We're going to fuck shit up. We're going to get the remaining League of Non-Aligned Worlds that are teamed up with us and the Rangers. We're going to mount a fleet in a week and go to Zaha Doom and attack them. Little does she know that they've moved away from Zaha Doom and have gone.
Because they were afraid of this, probably.
And yes, that's what they were, and have gone to Centauri Prime. But she's going to mount the offensive to go get her boyfriend back. Would you do that for me?
If I was in Delenn's place, yeah.
Got it on tape, everyone. She said she would do it for me, knowing that my first words would be yum yum when she saved me. Rachel said that she would do it. Rachel, they can't see the big smile on your face. You have to tell them about
you, motherfucker! Was that better? Did that communicate the big smile?
Yum, yum.
I complained earlier about my initial disdain and overall disgust about Sheridan and what he was going through with Lorien and all of the... the wanky, ooh, look at me, I'm a mysterious entity character.
JMS splooging on the screen.
Yes, JMS splooging on the screen. So that was my initial reaction. What about you? What did you think of Lorien to begin with?
What the fuck? Why? What the fuck does that even mean?
So you were a fan then? I love the design.
Yeah.
And the performance is good.
Stunning.
Wayne but Alexander.
On first viewing, not a fan. Did not like. Thought that this was all bullshit. And I still feel like it's bullshit, but bullshit with a purpose.
It lines up with where we go forward.
Yeah. It's like it tracks this. I go back to the idea of like it's the cogs needs to happen.
Yeah. Look, I like it, but not for a lot of the reasons that I am supposed to like it. So what pushes it along for me is the brilliant characterization from Wayne Alexander. I love his portrayal of the character. I think he is truly alien and ancient and mystical. Those eyes of his are very expressive.
You, I shouldn't say you because maybe we would not deal this way, but definitely for me, I believe him when he says that he was old when the land was forming on Earth.
When he reveals that he is not one of the first ones, but the first one, that was a great payoff.
Yeah.
Like, that was a great reveal, I should say. I do remember that when I heard that, I did react, oh, that was a successful hit there. And that's where I'm coming at it from, where I appreciate this on a retrospective level of looking at it going, oh yes, we're going to go here with the character and they're going to do this and they're setting up the stuff with Sheridan and him being alive but being dead and how we're going to bring him back and blowing on the embers of life and the tick and talk and all of the mechanics of where we go here. I appreciate that because this is the foundation to a lot of stuff that will matter to the very end of the show. But actually enjoying this or gravitating towards this on a genuine emotional level, not present. I get, if anything, the strongest emotional reaction I have is humor from it because I find Sheridan's incredulous energy towards this wizard-like character to be very
in a loop,
or that he's got no pulse.
It's a trick.
It's a trick. I love the dumb Sheridan against this guy that is timeless and has all of the wisdom and knowledge of the universe, and the shadows have built monuments to him, and Sheridan is just, I don't believe you. I think you're a liar. I'm going to keep walking until I prove otherwise. That's fun to me. That was the most enjoyable part on a connective level. But from what I get out of this, it is just, this is good homework for the assignment that we'll be getting throughout the season or the rest of the series. But really, it is the strength of the performance of Wayne Alexander. And he does have some good lines. There are some brilliant lines thrown in there.
And some of them are fun because they're so... I'm going to be honest. I was going to go with a different phrase, but like some of them are fun because they're so wanky.
They're very flowery and...
philosophical.
And just... B5 is just weird because we get those cuts of Sheridan being globbed on by the big energy thing that is Lorien. And then you just cut back to this. And it is very, very weird what Sheridan is going through, especially if you're watching it that first time and you have no idea what's happening and where they're going with this. And so the weird factor is very much appreciated by me, because Babylon 5 has lots of weird things in there, but there's also so many grounded elements that keep it at bay from just swinging off into whimsy, mysterious shit like a Lost or a Heroes, where you just go, okay, another weird thing, and you almost become detached. Here, they have a right amount of just it happening every now and then. So Lorien being this embodiment of the strangeness that we get is one of those things where he does, although at first make me roll my eyes, he does make me lean forward in my seat because I'm curious of what he's going to do and what he's in, and who he is and what his intentions are.
Surrender yourself to death. The death of flesh. The death of fear. Step into the abyss and let go.
This is the part of the show where we select an actor or actress in this episode, typically a guest performer, to highlight. To look
to spotlight, perhaps? Is that right, Rachel?
You stole my line. But okay.
Whose line is it anyway? Is it yours or is it mine? Hey, was this Michael Keaton ever on Spotlight?
We are.
I think he was in Spotlight.
Doing. Anthony DeLongis.
Who was that? Is that the Centauri Guard I love so much?
No.
Oh, was
bartender.
That? But oh, the owner of the bar, please. He did the most important thing you could ever do in a Babylon 5 story. Start and engage in a pipe fight.
He snitched.
He did snitch. He had possibly one of my favorite lines in the episode, which was when he found out about the bounty on Jakar.
Which is worth more.
Which is worth more.
Dead or alive.
I loved his line delivery. His line delivery and his face when saying it was pitch perfect. Just to get into the performance, because this is an episode where there's not a lot of new guest stars. There's either recurring ones we've already had or just little players. And so
we did Wagner.
Was that?
Don't worry, I combined two names. Don't worry about
it. We did Wang now. Yeah, so we did Wang now. I don't know what you said. But we'll never know, and Rachel's never going to tell us. So we did Wang now.
I meant to say Alexander's last name, but it came out as Wagner. Wagner. And I'm like, that's not right.
Alexander Wagner. I don't know who that is either. Nobody knows what Rachel's saying.
Who did he play Lorien?
A Wayne. Wayne. We got here, guys. This is called professional podcasting. Follow us on Patreon where you get to hear some even better mispronunciations from Rachel. Patreon, Yum Yum Podcast on Patreon. So what I was going to say was, overall, this is an episode with little players. And the little players only have some small moments. But this particular actor, I thought, made his time on the screen worth it. You can tell that this is a guy that came in and he said, I know how to play this sleazebag right. He didn't play him so sleazy that it was a caricature, but with enough of a character to it. When he walks in and goes, yeah, well, it's my bar. I believed him. I said, yeah, you own the bar on the little lightning planet. I totally buy you. I totally believe you when you say that. And when he whacked the pipe down, I'm like, yeah, you're a guy that carries a pipe. But I overall enjoyed his performance. He's the type of performer where he makes playing these basically nothing thankless roles look entertaining to do. As an actor, I wouldn't know what to do with a role like this because it is so just serviceable of a character. Like, it's a nothing thing. But this guy, he had some energy to it that I enjoyed. What about you? What about you? He's a little sleazeball, but yeah. What do you think?
I've never really given him that much thought. It's just like, oh, okay, he's here. He's an ass. And then we move on.
Do you think he got paid?
Yeah.
What do you think he spent the money on? Do you think he got a new
buying
bar?
Buying a bar on
a non-lightning planet?
Yes.
on a rain planet instead?
Yeah, I think he upgraded, but only slightly.
Only a little.
Yeah.
Only a little. So are you familiar with Anthony's work? Have you seen him in anything in particular?
I have seen him in a couple of different things. I know things that he's been in.
Mm.
Because we'll work our way up to his big thing that we've both seen in.
Well, yes. So he is the embodiment of a Spotlight Babylon 5 actor. He has been in
130-something acting roles.
He plays the small roles. He plays
one episode
wonders or minor roles. He is very much like Marshall Teague or Patricia Tolman, where has a background in stunt acting or acting in other avenues. I know that he is a professional fencer, so one of his early roles was being the fence. Yes, we'll get to the bull whipping, but a fencing double was one of his earliest works on his IMDb, and I found that rather interesting. I said, ooh, I don't think I've ever seen on any actor's IMDb that their credit was actually that they were there to do fencing.
I enjoyed that he was the fencing coordinator in 9 episodes of iCarly.
I want to hear that story. I want to hear that fucking story. What were they doing on iCarly? Somebody write into us, yumyumpod@gmail.com. Tell us about the episodes of iCarly where I guess Carly goes fencing? I have no clue. I've never watched a single episode of... Was it the one with Fred? Was Fred fencing Carly? I don't know. I've never watched iCarly.
How intense does the choreography need to be?
For kids?
Get a specifically a fencing coordinator, not just like a fight choreographer, but fencing.
Well, did you not know about the Zorro arc of iCarly?
No, I've never watched.
I don't know. I'm making it up. But what I mean by he's the embodiment of a spotlight actor is he's an actor that has appeared in a gajillion things, small roles. He has a stunt and or fighting background. He has a background where also he has worked in projects that we often see these actors come from. The Twilight Zone, Murder, She Wrote, things of
General
that.
General
Hospital. I don't know if he did.
Which was his first role.
But he has a lot of those credits that we often see time and time again because
Dukes
we know
of
Babylon,
Hazzard.
Dukes of Hazzard, where Babylon 5 either has a casting person who draws from this pool or they have actors that know people or JMS has previously worked on shows and so he knows certain actors that he likes and he can bring them in. And as soon as I saw that he had a more of a fighting or stunt background, because a lot of the characters he plays, including in this episode, are the type that get into a brawl, into a rumble, into a tussle, I did want to know if he had worked with Marshall Teague or Patricia Tolman, because both of those actors in B5 have that background themselves. And so he was in Roadhouse.
Yes.
Which is good to know. He was in Roadhouse, which I don't remember specifically. I haven't watched Roadhouse in a while. I always remember Marshall Teague in that. You can't forget Marshall Teague. But I'm sure if I rewatch it, I'll see this guy. I wonder if he owns Roadhouse. I'm kidding. I know he doesn't. But imagine if he owned a rival bar and his bar's on a set that's always having lightning happen. And he has a pipe and he smacks it down.
Yeah.
And lets you know that it's his bar. It's my bar. But has he worked with Patricia Tolman by any chance? Because that was the only thing he's done with Marshall Teague. Again, they were both on Texas Walker Ranger, but not at the same time, I don't think. But has he worked with Pat Tolman by any chance?
Yes. Yes, he has. According to IMDb, they both are in 4 different titles together. Mm. So they were both in Roadhouse.
Was she in Roadhouse?
Apparently.
I didn't realize that. Well, that's interesting. I imagine she did stunts.
Yeah.
For like Patrick Swayze, of course.
I didn't go in and double checked what each of them were in these roles.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Just does a comparison search. CIA 2 Target Alexa from 1993.
Okay. That would have been the start of B5, yeah.
B5.
Mm-hmm.
And Voyager.
Yeah. So, Voyager. I didn't realize about Pat Tolman did Voyager. I knew she did TNG and Deep Space Nine.
So, he was in multiple episodes.
Yes, but yes, yes. And I have a lot of opinions on his episodes and what he was.
The one that she was in too is, I think, his last one, which is Basics.
Part one. Yeah, that's the one where Brad Dourif has to kill a bunch of the Kazons to get Voyager back. So we even have another B5 person there. So mm-hmm. that's interesting.
It's those 4. So yeah. 3 other projects.
Okay, that is cool. I rather like that. So I want to flag it up since we just brought it up. So Voyager, do you remember him in Voyager?
When I saw him in the makeup, I did, because I looked, I went to Memory Alpha.
Oh, I knew immediately when I saw his name.
With the dude's name. I was like, I feel like it's from this stage of Voyager. And then, because I was, you know, when you like read something, but you don't fully read it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, yeah. That's his fucking title, and then it's his name.
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as that happened and I saw his face, I was like, oh.
He's the main antagonist of Voyager's first 2 seasons.
Yes, he's around for a while.
He is the head Kazon that they have to deal with, the one that's teamed up with Seska.
And wants to steal their tech.
And he believes that Seska is with his child and doesn't realize it's Chakotay's child. He is one of the worst villains I've ever seen in all of Star Trek. The Kazons suck. And this guy is boring. That's his thing. He's boring. And that's where I want to just...
He's bad at his job.
He is.
Like, in text.
He is the craziest thing.
He's bad at his job. Here's
the weirdo, wacko thing. Is he's given more in Voyager than he is in Babylon 5. And yet, in Babylon 5, for the 2 seconds he's here, has more presence, more memorable qualities and charisma than he does in those episodes of Voyager, where he is the lead foe to the heroes. And that just says a lot about Voyager's writing, but also the direction that Voyager had, because I know that you didn't pay much attention to him here, and I know many people listening don't either. Many people watching it, just watching a show, just watches the show and don't really think too heavily about these little players, like especially these ones that are so minute. And we are, because we're doing a whole section of the show about them. But as a viewer myself, I do keep an eye on these people because they do...
They can make or break an episode a lot of the time.
They do the unsung work that we have in TV. And so... I looked at him here and I had a flavor of a character that made the scenes far more enjoyable. While with Voyager, none of that's present with him. He's a complete void. And it just says everything about the failings of Voyager. And I am a fan and defender of that series. So you know that's saying a lot when even I, somebody who will vehemently defend Voyager when given the chance, says, that guy fucking sucks. And it's a lot of the writing and a lot of the direction and just the overall presentation.
The Borg encountered a Kazon colony in the Gan sector, grid 6920.
Why, they assimilated?
Their biological and technological distinctiveness was unremarkable. They were unworthy of assimilation.
I didn't realize the Borg were so discriminating.
Why assimilate a species that would detract from perfection?
Good point.
I just want to list off some other things. He was in the OG Battlestar from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
A-18.
Mm-hmm.
V.
Done a bunch of just sci-fi things here and there.
Las Vegas as very big guy.
Do you think he was a big guy?
Mm-hmm. He was also in the show Grimm.
Oh, yeah. I remember Grimm.
He was in Chipmunk's Adventure as Klaus.
Don't forget he was in the Charles Grodin classic Clifford.
Yeah.
Just wanted to.
He was also in a Star Trek video game, a couple of different voices. He was in The Riches.
Oh, the Eddie Izzard show?
Yes, as Redneck.
You don't say. You don't. It was in Masters of the Universe. That's important.
Yeah. Yes, we'll get into that. Do you want to get into that now?
He does a lot of video game voice acting. He was, in fact, one of the marshals in the first Red Dead Redemption game. And I kind of do remember him, actually. Mm-hmm. So that is neat. Recently, he's done a lot more low-budget affairs, a lot of those shitty murder, like, serial killer things, like a Ted Bundy thing, and, you know, that's just...
He was in Gangster Squad, though.
Who wasn't in Gangster Squad?
That was such a weird fucking movie.
No, not weird. Boring. Forgettable. Lame.
No, the fact that it had so many people in it is the weird thing about it, and it is shit.
Oh, he was Mr. F number 2 in Arrested Development in one of the later seasons, so I haven't seen that.
Yes, which is, he may have gotten that because he worked on The Millers.
Oh, with Will Arnett. I can imagine Will Arnett.
Where he played, apparently, the Pope. That's not a show that I've seen, but I was just like, we should mention that he apparently played the Pope, and we're assuming that the Pope is the Catholic Pope, a nickname or something.
If you had to play a big figure like that.
A big religious figure?
No, just like a big, significant figure. Mm. Like if
like
someone was looking at
somebody's biopic?
Whatever. Like if we were scrolling through your IMDb and we had like Rachel played the Pope. Like, what's that for you? Like, what would you want to play, like, that level of, like, what the hell? Rachel played Thatcher? That's crazy. I didn't realize that Rachel could play Margaret Thatcher. For myself, I would really love to play, looking at the world of things. I would really like it if someone scrolled through my IMDb and they saw Mussolini in there. They're like, whoa, wait. Ryan played Mussolini? That's a bit weird. He's not even Italian.
Yeah.
He's Polish. Well, I just think it would be very amusing if you went through my acting reel and you just saw like normal classic like comedy things from me and then like deadly serious Mussolini thrown in there. I think that would be a chuckle thing. What about you? Anything?
I can't think of anything really. So my joke answer is Pauline Hanson.
The Australian politician, Pauline Hanson. People, if you are not up to date with Australian politics, look up Pauline Hanson and have a terrible night.
Look up Pauline Pants Down.
That's a good one too, the Australian comic. But keep going with his roster. What else have we got? Because he's been in a lot of things, both behind the camera and in front.
The other thing that I had noted before we get to Masters of the Universe is that he directed and starred in a short called Duke, which is all about John Wayne.
Johnny Wayne!
So he played John Wayne, and he's produced a couple of things.
That's neat.
And do you want to go Masters of the Universe or Batman first?
Oh, we've got to go the Batman.
Okay.
Tell me about the Batman.
So he was a bullwhip trainer.
He was also in Batman Returns as an evil clown alongside Doug Jones, who was also one of the evil, weird little clown freaks. Yes, so talk to me about Batman Returns and his whipdom in it.
Well, this is your fact, so I think you should give it.
So this guy is also a bullwhip expert and has worked on films teaching actors how to use whips. Michelle Pfeiffer
runs a ranch.
He runs a ranch. He also gives lessons on stage fighting and combat. But he taught Michelle Pfeiffer how to use a whip for Batman Returns, which is very important, in fact. And to this day, Michelle Pfeiffer still knows how to use a whip. She's even demonstrated it in videos in recent years that she still is handy with the whip. And he also worked on Indiana Jones, and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull to help Harrison Ford get his whip skills back in order. So this guy has made his mark on cinema in ways that we haven't touched upon in the podcast before, which is the fact that, one, he's a fencing expert. I just think that's something I have never acknowledged before when it comes to an actor. But he's also helped iconic characters and actors use whips. That is just, I love that. I think that is so cool. And this just lines up with, like, with Marshall Teague, say, where Marshall Teague has this background where it's like, of course he's an expert in this and this and this. That's this guy where there's, like, a trivia that he's a part of a knife-throwing club and, oh, he's in the Knife Throwers Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And he has this black belt or this, like, martial arts thing, or he's an expert
fifth
in this.
Fifth degree black belt and inducted into the Black Belt Hall of Fame, according to IMDb.
Expert fencer. Like, he is just awesome. Like, you read it and you go, that's awesome. How do you find the time to be all of these things?
I love that he was in Masters of the Universe. And he's, like, a relatively small role. So he's also...
No, that was Billy Barty. He was a relatively small role.
he's
a little
also...
bit of Billy Barty humor for you. A little bit of Billy Barty humor.
He was also Skeletor's stunt double.
He was really Frank Langella's stunt double? That's cool. That's cool.
Now, I, Skeletor, am master of the universe.
It's time for the rating. Do we give Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi a yum for bad or a yum yum for good? No,
what is it,
in
Ryan?
Betweens.
Overall,
this was just okay.
But does it make it bad?
Well,
or does it make it good?
Here's the thing. No, listen.
As you just
listen,
said.
Listen to me. Don't look around me. Don't look through me. Listen to me.
I just want a clear yum or yum yum from you, Ryan. That's
for,
what I want.
For Babylon 5, this is a yum yum.
Yum yum.
For season 4, it's a yum. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, that's what I was going to say. Because I'm like, it's okay. But, like, we know what we get in this season. And
we know what we've gotten.
It's so much more. It can do so much better.
But it's still, like, a great episode for the other season.
It's still a great episode of TV, but it's a yum from me as well.
Yum.
Well, you give it a yum. I gave it a yum yum for Babylon 5. You give it a yum. I gave it a yum yum. I gave it a yum yum for B5 and a yum for season 4.
Okay, so is your official rating?
It's officially a yum yum.
Okay, it's officially a yum from me.
Yeah,
because like I'm in the same boat. Like it, but it's just like if anything's gonna get a yum this season, it's probably this episode because of how much more we get.
Well, let's hear what we're getting next time on Babylon 5.
On the next Babylon 5.
Episode 3, The Summoning. According to the DVD, the plot is as such. Delenn's public attempt to rally League worlds against the Shadows appears futile until Sheridan unexpectedly arrives at the gathering. Okay, spoilers. Garibaldi also returns. Oh, okay. But something about him doesn't seem right. Oh boy, oh jeez, oh boy, oh wow. So, thank you all so much for listening along to us Babylon about Babylon 5. Oh, that was clever, huh, Rachel? I'm sure nobody's ever made that statement before. No one's ever said it. No one's ever made a podcast of their own called that. Never. That was a fresh new take that you can only hear here at Yum Yum Podcast, the only Australian Babylon 5 podcast. But Rachel, pleasure talking to you about the B5 stuff. Could you inform all of the yumlings, those are the people who listen, where we can be found on the internet? How can people find us and where can people contact us at?
If you search Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast on various social medias that people typically use, you will find us, or you can go straight to that description, and those links are handily provided for you. If you want to send us an email, as Ryan mentioned earlier in the podcast, it is yumyumpod@gmail.com. If you want another way to contact us, you can join up to our Patreon, where you get access to a private Discord server.
And a buttload of content. That's right, a whole butt.
It's more than a butt at this point.
It's so much butt that is content in there. There's just so, it's overwhelming amount of content. We are talking about Aliens, the franchise. We are talking about Star Trek franchise. We are going episode by episode through Space Above and Beyond, a television series that is often overlooked in the sci-fi TV pantheon, and not a lot of people talk about it, but we're talking about it over there on our Patreon, so come on over. As Rachel said, all of this is in the description below. If you have not rated and reviewed the podcast, well, it would be nice if you did that. That's all I'll say, and that is all I'm going to say, other than what Jakar should have said when he met Emperor Katarja, which is, good eating to you!